Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We first declared September the 11th International Burn a Quran Day, actually for two reasons. Number one, we wanted to remember those who were brutally murdered on September the 11th. And actually, we wanted to send a very clear message to the radical element of Islam. We wanted to send a very clear message to them that we are not interested in their Sharia law. We do not tolerate their threats, their fear, their radicalness.
Hushabai, Reverend. Hushabai, Reverend. Hush, hush, Reverend. Hush, hush, Reverend. Hush, hush, Reverend. Don't burn Qurans, but urinate on a Bible. That's okay to the boys at the Brooklyn Museum. Remember that, Reverend? Remember when the good old boys at Old Brooklyn Museum dipped a crucifix in urine? Remember when an artist from Africa put a crucifix in elephant dung? Reverend, there was no outcry and there was no interference by a general. What's interesting to me, ladies and gentlemen, is that we have a general, General Petraeus, in Afghanistan, doing the best he can under the circumstances, given that we have a liberal commander-in-chief who really doesn't want to go to war. He'd rather switch than fight. And so, therefore, the general says burning the Quran will endanger our troops. Now, I can't say whether it will really endanger our troops any further than having an Afghani soldier shoot our troops in the back, which was done apparently last night while you slept, while you were getting over your hangover, while you were digesting your fatty meal. One of these so-called Afghani soldiers fragged eight of our men. So I really don't know that this burning of the Quran puts any of our troops in any greater danger than they're already in when they're in a den of vipers and there's no such thing as an Afghani soldier that you can trust. But let's go to the main point. When the boys at Brooklyn College, the left-wing, cockamamie, anti-American Christophobes at Brooklyn College several years ago displayed a crucifix in a jar of urine, there was no such outcry from a general. In fact, I find it very odd that I'm the only one in the media who sees a separation of church and state issue with the top general in the United States of America commenting on an act by a little country pastor who says he's going to burn Qurans outside of his church on September 11th. The issue to me is not whether or not he should burn Qurans. That's frankly his business. It's not mine. It's very akin to burning the American flag, wouldn't you say? All you good left-wing lawyers in New York, all you cockamamie left-wing fanatics, the kind of guys who talk about the First Amendment, you left-wing liars, you who go over and make sure that Chavez gets elected. You know who I'm talking to, don't you? Are you listening to the show? Are you listening, old left-winger, you? All you First Amendment phonies, you flew over with Jimmy Carter and you made sure that the dictator Chavez could get elected with a phony election. You're the same type who defended the Nazis when they marched in Skokie. You're the same type who defended the right to burn the American flag. Well, where are you on the issue of this preacher saying he's going to burn Qurans? Haven't heard a word from you, all you First Amendment guys. Why, you're the same First Amendment lawyers who didn't go to bat for Michael Savage when he was banned in England, because you're nothing but a bunch of, well, you know what I think of you. You know what I think of you. I think you're the type to destroy the American dream. Those of you who wrap yourself in the First Amendment the most loud are usually the worst of the worst. So I've cleared the air today on this subject. I could ask you a question, but I'm not going to do it because there's nothing to ask and there's nothing to tell. Today being a Tuesday on the Savage Nation, I have a new format which I initiated last week. Monday is about cars or dogs or food or restaurants. Tuesday is about books or movies that change your life, and you can call me on that one. And the reason we're doing books or movies that change your life, because to billions of people on the earth who are illiterate, who have never read another book, the Quran is self-sufficient. There is no need for any other book. They would gladly burn The Catcher in the Rye, The Day of the Locust, The Grapes of Wrath, The Great Gatsby, 1984, On the Road, The Sun Also Rises. They would gladly burn these great novels of Western literature because they believe in the single sufficiency of the one book, the Quran. And so, therefore, the questions for the Savage Nation today are, which book or movie changed your life? Which book or movie is considered great by the midstream media, which you feel is overrated? Do you feel it's, well, I can ask you some dumb questions. I'm not going to do it. But do you remember coming out of a movie when you were a kid that was such, they have different words for it today. I think Obama uses the phony word transformational. And, of course, he is transforming the White House. Tonight they're having a dance fest in the White House, which for the first time will include bumping and grinding in the White House. And this is to show you how classy the Obamas really are. Not only did they redecorate it looking like a rental, a place full of rental furniture, taking away any vestige of dignity in the White House, but now they're bringing in dance troops into the White House who will be demonstrating the bump and grind somewhere in the once great White House. So don't think that things have not been transformed by Obama. Not only did he wreck the economy, not only did he destroy NASA, not only did he weaken the military, not only did he water down religion in America, but now he's out to destroy the image of America unto itself. And don't think he's not going to achieve it, by the way, in your lifetime. And so I say to you, did you ever come out of a movie and find your life was altered in some way? You remember seeing a movie as a kid when you walked out and you were in that surreal state and you said, oh, my God, I want to be like that person? And where are the movies like that today when we have the drug-addicted scum of the earth who have taken over Hollywood, who produce one after the other slasher movie? Do I have to go down the list? Do you want me to get angry today? Because I don't want to get angry today. Take a look at what's happened to this country where the only role model for an actress is either that of a drug addict or a degenerate tattoo artist puncturing herself on the weekend while disguising herself as Snow White in the middle of the night in her dreams. The fact of the matter is, the worst minds of our generation have degenerated the culture and the arts to an extent that there's almost nothing left holding on to in the United States of America. The lowest of the low have taken over Hollywood and the media. The vermin of the earth have so polluted the airwaves, and the garbage that comes out of the sewer pipe of Hollywood has now so permeated America that there's not a movie worth going to. You certainly wouldn't want your children to go in there to come out as a pervert or as a slasher or a drug addict, would you? So I ask you, which movie was transformational in your life? Who did you come out wanting to be like after seeing a movie? Or which book have you ever read that changed your life? You ever read a book that made you into something else? I did. I can name a few of them. I read magazines that changed my life. And so, therefore, at this juncture, I will take a quick, no break. No, not now. Can't do that. I just got started on the Savage Nation. As you well know, I'm a famous author. Last week, I began this segment by reading a list. I don't have them, and I'm not going to do it again. My voice is a little bit on the laryngitis side today from too long a weekend and too many hours on the boat in the cold bay. But I've written 25 or so books. Oh, only five of them were on the New York Times bestseller list. But that doesn't count to the vermin in the media. What counts is a book that bashes America, not a book such as Liberalism is a Mental Disorder or The Enemy Within or the new one coming out, Trickle Up Poverty, Stopping Obama's Attack on Our Borders, Economy, and Security. Those aren't real books. Real books would be those that attack your mother, your father, your grandmother, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, the Constitution. You know, books like that. Now, that's a real book. A book by Nancy Pelosi that sells 300 copies, although she had all the publicity in the world. Now, that's a real book. A book by Hillary Clinton. Now, that's a real book. Those are real books, not books by conservatives like Michael Savage. So I go way back with my books, and books have transformed me, and so have magazine articles. For example, when I was a kid, what magazines did I read? I like Boy's Life magazine. Can you imagine there was a magazine called Boy's Life? which spoke to the male within the boy rather than the unisexual creature within every boy. A magazine that tried to make boys into men is what I read as a boy. And I tried to become a man as a little boy because I knew that's what I was expected to become. It was not left up to me to decide what I wanted to be. My sexuality was not considered to be ambivalent. I wasn't told that I was a creature that can go any way, make it with a man, make it with a woman, make it with a dog. No, I was told to get married and have children because that's the way of the world. So you see, I'm kind of an old-fashioned type of guy. I read Boy's Life as a boy. I didn't read Metrosexual Life as a boy. And so, therefore, that was one of the magazines I liked. I liked reading my father's magazines, Argosy, another men's magazines for working-class men. Actual real men who stayed home with the wife and children at night. Men who stayed home with the wife and children at night. Men whose wives and children had a husband at night. Men who stayed home with the wives and children at night. Children who had husbands and fathers at night in the house. Wives who had a husband in the house at night. That's when America was great. That's when the chrome was thick and the women were straight. I'll be back.
Savage.
So today's show, it's interesting, is about books and movies that change your life. And here we have a general speaking out against a pastor who wants to burn Qurans outside his church in Florida. To me, this is a clear issue of church and state. Here we have the Obama state stepping on a church. Irrespective of what you or I think about the pastor burning the Qurans, the government has no right telling them they cannot burn Qurans. After all, many verminous liberals have burned flags over the years, and they said, well, that's what our soldiers are dying for. They're dying for the right for us to burn flags in America. And we're dipping a picture of Jesus in urine. I'm Larry Davis. I can urinate on a picture of Jesus. But I'm a funny guy from Brooklyn. And we own Hollywood. All of us clowns from Brooklyn own Hollywood. We can pee on Jesus. And you can't do a thing because you're nothing but a bunch of weak-kneed, liver-loving Christians who do nothing to anybody. So we'll pee on a picture of Jesus. But don't you dare talk against building a mosque on Ground Zero. And don't you dare let that cracker burn Qurans, say the boys from Brooklyn. Two soldiers killed in Iraq, 9 wounded. How? By a so-called Afghani soldier who fragged them. There's no such thing as an Afghani soldier. There's no such thing as an Iraqi soldier. Actually, it's an Iraq, excuse me. There's no such thing as an Iraqi soldier. They're all members of Al-Qaeda, or they're waiting to become one. And this is what goes on. Iraqi soldier opened fire today on a group of U.S. soldiers in northern Iraq, killing 2 and wounding 9 others. First American deaths in Iraq since Obama ended the combat mission last week. Now, of course, Obama's too busy to talk about it. He's busy getting ready for the bump and grind show in the White House. But the fact of the matter is the shooter has a name. His name is Saran Rahman from the Iraq Army's 4th Division. The man got into a fight with U.S. soldiers and then pulled his weapon and fired on them before he was shot dead. So there it is. The soldiers were part of a security element for a U.S. company commander who was meeting with members of Iraqi security forces. So this guy waxed their security. Now, you have to ask yourself how that happened. Want my guess? Do you want my guess? I'll bet our boys went in there unarmed. I'll bet that our soldiers were disarmed by the general in Iraq. After all, they were a security element for a U.S. company commander who was meeting with members of Iraqi security. And so, therefore, to show how good we are as Americans, our boys will not even go on in with a sidearm. That would be my guess. But the Iraqis could be armed because, after all, it's their country. And as you well know, you can always trust someone from Iraq and Afghanistan because they're not white males. The only people you can't trust are white males. The only people you can trust would be, let's say, a soldier from the third world. They're trustworthy because they come from superior cultures. They were not burdened with Jesus as a child. They were enlightened as children to the superior ways of the world. And so, therefore, Obama just makes certain that more of our boys died by sending them in disarmed, and an Iraqi soldier kills 2 and wounded 9. Why couldn't they kill him when he opened fire? You'll never know why, because Petraeus will never release the reason why. Mike's guess? You want Mike's guess today, because I'm always right? Mike's guess is because our soldiers were unarmed. Another party at the White House tonight, bumps and grinds. That's right, bumps and grinds. Michelle is right up to form. Lectures us about health foods and eats junk food. Tells you to lose weight and she gains weight. Tells you she's the classiest woman in the world and she redecorates the White House, making it look like a Burger King bathroom. Harry Reid, I had nothing to do with the bad economy. Chicago mayor won't seek re-election. I wonder why. How come Mayor Daley won't seek re-election? You think it has anything to do with the... Want Mike's guess? Here's a second one for Mike's guess. You know, this is actually a good segment of the show. It's called Mike's Guess. Why won't Boss Daley run again in Chicago? How come Boss Daley won't run? Could it have anything to do with Blago's trial? Rigoletto, I Rigoletto. Could it have anything to do with Blago's trial? After all, he played the clown, but he was no fool. I mean, he played the clown, but Blago was no one's fool. In fact, Blago went to trial and came out unscathed. How's that? Because he must have had something on somebody. That's the way of American justice. It's not who you know. It's what you know, but you didn't even know what you know meant. It's not actually what your knowledge base is. It's what you got on someone. So when you hear someone say, oh, it's not who you know, it's what you know, what they really mean is what you know about others that you can blackmail them with. See, that's how it works. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. We're talking about great books. So Times critics, who are all lefties, list the 100 best English language novels. I'll read some of them because some of them I agree with. The ones that are not on the list are the important ones to pay attention to. And they're in alphabetical order. The Adventures of Augie March by Saul Bellow, a stiff. Animal Farm by George Orwell, critically important. Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger, very important. Clockwork Orange, 1963, by Anthony Burgess, a work of genius. The Day of the Locust by Nathaniel West, 1939. I couldn't get through the first 12 pages. Gone with the Wind, didn't touch it. Costume piece. Grapes of Wrath, 10 pages.
Savage.
We live in the United States of America. We want to send a clear message to the peaceful Muslims. We have freedom of speech. We have freedom of religion. They are more than welcome to be here, more than welcome to worship, more than welcome to build mosque. But our 9/11 demonstration, our 9/11 protest, is to send a clear message to the radical element of Islam that we will not tolerate that in America.
So whether you agree with Reverend Terry Jones or not isn't the issue. The issue is when the boys from Brooklyn College had an art show where a crucifix was dipped in a jar of urine, you thought that was funny and fine. When Larry David urinated on a picture of Jesus, you thought that was hilarious. When the American flag was burned during the Vietnam War protests, and you were a pothead, you thought that was freedom of speech. But where do you stand today when Reverend Terry Jones wants to burn a Quran? Now imagine if America was ruled by a group of reverends who said every book in America has to be burned, all the libraries have to be burned, and the only book that will be allowed will be the Christian Bible. You'd say that's impossible, it couldn't happen. Well, of course it can't happen here, but it happened many, many, many eons ago, when the Muslim armies, invaded Alexandria, Virginia. Remember, Alexandria, Egypt. It was named for Alexandria, Virginia. When the Muslim armies invaded Egypt, which was not a Muslim country at the time, it was a country of pagans, the Egyptian civilization was quite advanced. It had libraries and such, dams, and of course, tremendous edifices. But none of this mattered to the Muslim armies. And so they sacked the Alexandria Library and they burnt it to the ground, destroying every book. Because to them, there was only one book that any man needed, and that was the Quran. And so there are still some, I would suspect, who still live in the 8th century. And today, of course, they have automatic weapons and such. They have IEDs and such, and they own the American media. to a certain degree. Not outright, of course. They wouldn't own ABC, CBS, NBC outright. But they have this sympathy because, after all, anything but a white male and anything but the white male's religion to the vermin at the ABC, CBS, NBC cabal. And so when we read two soldiers killed and nine wounded by an Iraqi soldier today, you know the geniuses in the news business are not going to investigate and see how a security detail could be fragged by one Iraqi soldier. Of course, but Mike's guess is that the Iraqi was armed and the Americans were not, because we wanted to show that we're, well, a nice nation, a nation filled with atonement for the sins of George Bush, a nation that wants to be beloved by the Arabs, not distrusted. After all, we have the first Muslim president, at least in the eyes of most of the world and in half of America. And so, therefore, he has to be nice to his fellow travelers. And therefore, he must distrust those who are not of his particular orientation. Not overtly, but let us say in a way that most people have gotten the message. And that's why when I say we're talking about books today in the Savage Nation, there's no better topic for a day where we read that Reverend Terry Jones is going to burn a Quran or a bunch of them on September 11th. And General Petraeus says, you can't do it, don't do it. It'll endanger our troops. I would say General Petraeus has endangered our troops with his weak-livered rules of engagement. I would say General Petraeus is far more dangerous than Reverend Jones by permitting our men to go into a security meeting like this disarmed, if that's the case, because there is no other explanation for them getting killed. 11 men in a security detail at a meeting for a company commander, and one Iraqi kills all of them, kills two and wounds nine. The answer is because they went in unarmed. So General Petraeus, you're actually endangering our troops with your foolish rules of engagement, and we should come to understand a lot of things, and I don't want to go into the war right now. You know my feelings on this. And so I'll go back to Time Magazine's left-wing list of the 100 best novels. We left off with two that I said I never read. Gone with the Wind, couldn't read it. Grapes of Wrath, I mean, it's a book you thought you should like. I couldn't read it. The Great Gatsby, I read it. I was never moved by it. I mean, Hemingway likes Fitzgerald, so I read it. I didn't really find it that interesting. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers, good title. Herzog by Saul Bellow, Byzantine, unreadable. I'm reading a little. I, Claudius by Robert Graves, couldn't stand it, and I met Robert Graves afterwards. He was worse than his novels. Lolita by Vladimir Nabokov, big deal. Old man loves young girl. Lord of the Flies by William Golding, fabulous book. Actually, fabulous book. Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis. Never read it. The Man Who Loved Children. I wonder what that's about, by Christina Steed. Of course, it has a different meaning today. The Man Who Loved Children from 1940 is not the book The Man Who Loved Children today. The Man Who Loved Children is probably running the education department today. Native Son by Richard Wright. 1984 by George Orwell, written in 1948. One of the most important books I've ever read, because we're living in it. On the Road by Jack Kerouac, one of the most important books I ever read. But I can name five other books by Kerouac that changed my life. On the Road, Dharma Bums. You want me to name the others? The Subterraneans. Every one of them was transformational in my life. Got me out of the delicatessen crowd in Queens. Was it not for Jack Kerouac, I would have been eating corned beef on Club and died at 46 of a triple bypass coronary occlusion of the soul. Was it not for Jack Kerouac, I would have eaten schmaltz all my life and been fat at 35 and died a sick, broken man with a broken briefcase somewhere in a phone booth on 3rd Avenue. Was it not for Jack Kerouac and the incredible literature that turned me around and transformed me into the man I am today, I would have eaten corned beef and cabbage at Katz's. No, no, no. Corned beef and cabbage on bars on 8th Avenue after being rejected in business meetings. I would have gone to Katz's on Ludlow Street and had a double corned beef, make it thick on the schmaltz. Take me to Bellevue in a stretcher, please. Was it not for Jack Kerouac, I wouldn't be the man I am today. So he said, oy vey. Hey, look, I got to have fun. You know, boys just want to have fun, is the way it's said. So let me finish the list and we'll go. A Passage to India, E.M. Forster. I could read three pages of it, how to put it down. Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. Truly one of the most overrated books in history. In fact, the only reason Kurt Vonnegut was enjoyed is because he was a left-wing America hater. The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner, Byzantine, impossible to read unless you were a tenured English professor. The Sun Also Rises by Hemingway, very important book. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, couldn't touch it. The cover itself turned me off. Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller. Oh, let's add to that one. How about Black Spring by Henry Miller? Saved my life on many a dull night. When things weren't working in my life, I always turned to Miller. Whenever I reached a cul-de-sac in my own existence, I always found Miller. When the night was so dark, there were no stars in my future to follow. Out of the abyss, there was only Henry Miller. Under the Volcano by Malcolm Lowry, one of the most important books I've ever read. You want to get a real picture of Mexico and the real subterranean culture of Mexico and what you really can expect underneath the floating gardens of Xochimilco? Read Under the Volcano, but make sure you've had three drinks before you do. So that's my analysis of Time's list of the 100 best novels. Which would you add to this list? Which are the books that changed your life? What are the movies that changed your life? How about when you were a kid and you came out of a war movie and you wanted to be a hero? You wanted to go into the military because of it. Did any movie ever do that for you? How about when you were a kid and you saw a movie about a pilot flying over through a storm and he gets the people there safely? Did that make you want to be a pilot? How about a movie about a heroic submarine commander or a sea captain? Did that make you want to go in the Navy? How about a movie that inspired you to be something macho and something male and something purely American, as opposed to the garbage that's put out today that turns your son into a jelly roll that melts in the sun? How about it? Well, now that I've done the background, we can do the foreground. Now we can go forward onto the Savage Nation. Let's begin in Houston, Texas. Mike, which book was transformational in your life?
Mike, well, I'm 30 years old, but I think that The Catcher was so, it was genius, and it made me believe that, you know, I'm not the only person who has thoughts like Holden had, and, you know,
What did you mean thoughts? You mean what kind of thoughts, like Holden Caulfield, but what kind of thoughts? You mean the existential, who am I, what am I, why am I living?
Absolutely, and I read the book when I was, you know, 22 years old, and I read it in 3 days, and I was like, this is the greatest book I've ever read in my life, and we never had to read it in high school, and I graduate college, and I read the book, I'm like, man, it's the best freaking book I've ever read. And
The book is still taught in school, and it's a book about the angst of a late adolescent, you know, the sufferings of young Werther by Goethe really was the primary inspiration in some way for the Holden Caulfield character, A Catcher in the Rye. I mean, certainly it was original in one sense, but not original in the sense of the angst of the 18-year-old boy, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, people, when you're that age, and even when you're, you know, my generation, you're in your early 20s, people still consider you that age. And when you read the book, people never have had those kind of feelings before. You know, and that they can.
So, in other words, wait a minute. So Mallarmé, the French poet, wrote that the purpose of the artist is to make people. How did he put it? I used to know it in French. To make more clear the words of the tribe. I forget the French translation, but he wrote that the work of the artist is to make much more clear the words of the person. In other words, we can't articulate. The average person is not able to articulate what they feel or even what they see. But the artist's job is to help the person articulate what they see or feel. Isn't that what you're saying? Is that piece of literature is what did it for you, The Catcher in the Rye?
Absolutely. Because J.D. Salinger spoke to your average adolescent who had these thoughts, why am I here? And the ending of the book was like, you finally get it at the very end. So
Now I'm going to make a leap in faith, Mike, and I'm going to make it somewhat narcissistic and egotistical. Isn't the reason that you listen to this show is because I help you help you articulate what you see going on but don't quite know how to express?
Yeah, of course. I mean, without a doubt. I'm a 30-year-old, young, very conservative guy. Like you, I don't see myself as Republican, but I'm a very conservative
Exactly,
guy.
But you see yourself as an American who loves the country and sees it going down the tubes and sees a mess being made by the two interlopers in the White House. And you don't know what to say about it without fear that you're going to be attacked as a racist. But I give you the ability to do it, don't I?
Absolutely.
Yay! Let's hear it for Michael Savage Malamé. 1-800-449-8255. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me.
It is time to talk about books on the Savage Nation, because as I told you last week, whatever subject we talk about is going to lead us back to politics. Everything is political. If you were to tell me that you have trouble, well, now that's getting too grotesque and too burlesque, but you can more or less tell me, if you have trouble doing what you think I was going to say, I could make that political. Let's put it to you that way. So when I say to you the list of books by time, which includes one book by Henry Miller, which one was it that I said here? The Tropic of Cancer. All right. There were other books written by him, such as Tropic of Capricorn, but I think his single best book is Black Spring. Now, I would say that Henry Miller, although his books were banned by in the English-speaking world upon its publication in Paris in 1936, it was banned because of its sexual content. But the fact of the matter is the sexual fantasies of Henry Miller, and they were all fantasies, incidentally, were only a small part of his imagination. The other parts of his imagination, you can't ignore the other parts of his imagination because of his sexual fantasies. But Black Spring consists of a number of linked episodes that describe some of the years in his personal life, from recollections of his childhood in Brooklyn to his time in Paris, very much like I did in my book, Psychological Nudity, without sexual content and psychological nudity, because frankly, I think sexuality is boring and very personal. And if I want sexuality, I know where to get it. I don't have to get it from other. In other words, why mix it in with everything is my point. You know, that's another interesting question. Do you think sexuality is necessarily mixed into everything in order to make it interesting? I don't think you need to do it. Look how well I've done without it. I don't use dirty words. I don't talk about, underwear. I don't make offhanded dirty jokes, you know, like the balloon man does. Why would I do that? How did I become the third largest talk show host in the country at a rather late time in the day from an independent syndicator and have so many bestsellers without resorting to filth? The answer is because most Americans don't have filthy minds. So therefore, you don't have to do it. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And if you want it, you know where to get it. But it doesn't mean it has to be put into children's books. It doesn't mean it has to be put into every aspect of your life. Now, why did I like Black Spring as a book, and what did it do for me? Well, I don't want to go into it. It's not that important. It was just, I will go into it. It is important. There was a phase in my life that although I had done everything right, I was unable to get into the desired profession I wanted because I was cursed by being a white male. Ah, had I only been an illegal alien. Ah, had I only been a person of color, transvestite from the slums, then I would have had it made. But because I was a straight white male with a first class PhD and great credentials, God, they didn't want me at the university, so they had to hire everybody else. So I spent many a night saying, how the heck am I going to raise my two children? Where is the money going to come from? How am I going to pay my mortgage? And I'd watch my children sleep at night, and I'd see them, and I'd say, oh, my God, my poor children, what am I going to do if I can't make a living? I have gone to school at night while holding down two jobs and writing books so that I could get my union card and be a teacher in the colleges so that I could support you. How am I going to take care of you, my little darlings, I would think each night as I watched them sleep when they were young, and I didn't know what to do. I had no answer because my future was stolen from me by the ACLU and the other left-wing vermin who now run America. The very same evil forces that said white males need to put their futures on hold so that others may advance are the people who put Obama in the White House and have destroyed every aspect of our society. How's that for a single sentence that said more than anything you could ever read anywhere today? The very same vermin in the subversive anti-American, anti-male, anti-family, anti-Christian ACLU who made certain that white males of a certain persuasion were not hired in universities and therefore debased and destroyed most of the universities in America are the very same forces that have foisted Obama upon us and degenerated the entire culture. How's that for a second sentence? And so therefore, on those nights when I didn't know what the future might bring me, and I had nothing to go on except the stars and books and prayer, I remember staying up late at night. I can remember to this day finding another little book. I don't even remember the title of it. But I couldn't sleep. I was an insomniac. I didn't know what I would do. I didn't know if I could support my children. I didn't know if I could hold on to my house. They denied me my birthright. I was man-child in the promised land. I am the son of an immigrant. I had a dream, and they stole it from me. That's right. They said white males need not apply. So I couldn't sleep at night. I didn't know what I was going to do for my poor little children. How would I support them, I thought. And I'd look at the stars at night, and I really panicked. So then I found a book. This was not Henry Miller. And the book said, don't worry about not sleeping. In fact, it said man needs less sleep than he thinks. In fact, it said most of us sleep too much. In fact, it said think about what you could do in the middle of the night instead of sleeping. Like, learn all the star formations, which I did all over again. Like, read a book, write a novel, whatever you have to do. And I learned to love insomnia. I learned to look at the stars and look at the sky at night. And guess what? I never really lacked for sleep. You don't really need that much sleep, I found out. And eventually, I prayed. I learned prayer during that time period. I had nothing to do with Henry Miller now that I think about it. It had to do with some other spiritual forces. I don't know what they were. But I remember touching deeply into my own religion for the first time since childhood. And I remember standing on my little deck on a hillside somewhere in the San Francisco area, looking up at the mountaintop and praying to God to deliver me. And I said, God, please give me a living. I didn't ask for a fortune. I didn't want a fortune. I said, please give me a living. And he gave me a living. And here I am 16 years later. And let me tell you something. It came with a price. That's right. It was a deal.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Savage Nation, don't get scared. We don't have to wrap ourselves in the flag to wrap you around our cerebrum, do we? Did you get the horns already? Come on, come on, come on. Come on, getting there. Got that great song, George Gershwin, An American in Paris. It's an astonishing piece of music. Gershwin, the great American composer, goes to Paris. And to show you what a fertile mind is, he hears music where no one heard music. Listen. Loud. Come on. Let him hear it. Okay. He goes to Paris in the 20s. An altogether great time by what I read. I wasn't around, but enough of what I read told me I missed the great time. And he's in the taxi cabs, and he hears the horns, the taxi horns, and they're all kind of different. And he says, wait a minute, there's a symphony in this. So he brings back varieties of Parisian taxicab horns, and he incorporates them into an orchestra, and he creates this that you just heard, An American in Paris. This piece of it is astounding. But it also captures the cacophony of modern times. Remember when this was. This was after the classics had already died. It was after the chaos of World War I, where millions of boys were sacrificed for nothing. The gassings, the burnings, the bayonettings, the machine gunnings. And so it was a time of the roaring 20s when people wanted to let go and be wild. They couldn't take it anymore. And so an American composer named Gershwin creates this incredible piece called blah, blah, blah. So at the same time, Henry Miller's in Paris, or he goes to Paris from America. He also can't get anywhere, so he goes to Europe. And he couldn't stand America. He didn't like the prosaic aspects of America that only that he saw. Of course, he didn't understand what was great about the prosaic aspects of America. Like most artists, he was quite actually provincial in that view, in my opinion. Most American artists at that time had a very provincial view of America's provincialism. They didn't see the greatness of America's industrial machine, which unto itself was greater than some of the greatest art of all times. I mean, if you take a look, for example, at some of the constructions in the United States of America, they exceed that of the ancients. And in fact, they exceed that in beauty of that of the Acropolis. So the fact is that if you had a provincial view of America's provincialism, it's because you weren't seeing the greatness of America. And by the way, nothing has changed. The vermin on the left, who are basically provincial fools, who talk to each other, whether it be in the media or in academia, wherever they are, or in the universities, as I said, or in politics, they all have the same attitude that America stinks and everywhere else on earth is good. But they still love the greenback. And the fact is that were it not for tenure, we'd have a decent university system where some of the younger people would get a chance to teach instead of the old blowhards who do nothing and collect big checks and complain about how America is so horrible. Which leads me right back to great books, How Everything is Political, which is what we're talking about in The Savage Nation, in case you missed it. And now, ladies and gentlemen, do I have a treat for you. Because during the break, while you chewed gum, smoked a cigarette, had a corned beef on club and left it half uneaten because you couldn't wait to get back in the car and hear what I was going to say next, while you ate a hot dog on a stand on a hot street in New York, or you went for a soda in a cooler somewhere in the deep streets of Pittsburgh, while you were doing that, I was outside the radio studio pumping iron with my 20-pound dumbbells, because that's what I do during breaks in order to aerate my brain and my lungs, using the old heart-lung machine called the biceps and the old barbells. My production team downloaded Henry Miller himself reading from his novel, Black Spring. Play it.
It always seemed astounding to me how jolly they were in our family, despite the calamities that were always threatening. Jolly in spite of everything. There was cancer, dropsy, cirrhosis of the liver, insanity, thievery, mendacity, buggery, incest, paralysis, tapeworms, abortions, triplets, idiots, drunkards, ne'er-do-wells, fanatics, sailors, tailors, watchmakers, scarlet fever, whooping cough, meningitis, running ears, chorea, stutterers, jailbirds, dreamers, storytellers, bartenders, and finally, there was Uncle George and Tante Amelia. The morgue and the insane asylum. No one knew that Tante Amelia was going completely off her nut, that when we reached the corner, she would leap forward like a reindeer and bite a piece out of the moon, and nobody could think quick enough to stop it. Just like that it happened, in the twinkle of a star. And now I'm going to tell you what those bastards said to me. They said, Henry, you take her to the asylum tomorrow, and don't tell them that we can afford to pay for her. Fine. Always merry and bright. The next morning, we boarded the trolley together, and we rode out into the country. If Mealy asked me where we were going, I was to say to visit Aunt Monica. But Mealy didn't ask any questions. She sat quietly beside me and pointed to the cows now and then. She saw blue cows and green ones. She knew their names. She asked what happened to the moon in the daytime. And did I have a piece of liverwurst by any chance? During the journey, I wept. I couldn't help it. When people are too good in this world, they have to be put under lock and key. There's something wrong with people who are too good. It's true Mealy was lazy. She was born lazy. It's true that she was a poor housekeeper. It's true she didn't know how to hold on to her husband when they had found her one. When Paul ran off with the woman from Hamburg, she just sat in a corner and wept. The others wanted her to do something, put a bullet into him, raise a rumpus, sue for alimony. But Mealy sat quiet. She wept. She hung her head. She was like a pair of torn socks that are kicked around here, there, everywhere, always turning up at the wrong moment. And now she's very tranquil, and she calls the cows by their first name. The moon fascinates her. She has no fear because I'm with her, and she always trusted me. I was her favorite. Even though she was a half-wit, she was good to me. The others were more intelligent, but their hearts were bad. Sometimes when she was fired from a job, they used to send me to fetch her. Mealy never knew her way home. And I remember how happy she was whenever she saw me coming. She would say innocently that she wanted to stay with us. Why couldn't she stay with us? I used to ask myself that over and over. Why couldn't they make a place for her by the fire? Let her sit there and dream, if that's what she wanted to do. Why must everybody work, even the saints and the angels? Why must half-wits set a good example? I'm thinking now that after all, it may be good for Mealy where I'm taking her. No more work. Just the same, I'd rather they had made a corner for her somewhere. Walking down the gravel path toward the big gates...
right here. You're listening to the inimitable Henry Miller reading from his incredible novel, which I've been telling you about, Black Spring. Very few people that I've ever met know of it. They heard of Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, and they think their book's about sex. Little do they know who Henry Miller really is, and little do they know what Henry Miller is about, and little do they know he's one of the greatest writers of all time. Little do they know that Henry Miller was one of the great iconoclasts, and little do they know what the word iconoclast means. Little do they know that I drew great inspiration from this book in my Black Spring. Little do they know that Henry Miller was an iconoclast, and that the word iconoclast means he who knocks over icons. And little did they know that the word Mikhail, when translated from the Greek, means he who knocks over icons. And little did they know much about anything, let alone about everything, let alone about this thing or that thing. And I shall return with Henry Miller on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. Today we're talking about books that change your life and books that change the lives. And we started by talking about this and that, and we wound up with one of my favorites, Black Spring by Henry Miller, where I shared with you my Black Spring and how he helped me get through it. But the more important thing is for you to understand what changed your life, what was transformational in your life, whether it was a book or a movie. I don't think people read the way they did in my day. I don't think novels change anyone's life today, because the age of the great novelist has long been over. The novel changed into something new. The novel changed into the diary. The novel changed into the autobiography. The novel changed into talk radio. And today, of course, talk radio artists like Michael Savage are the novelists of 50 years ago. I have known this for a very long time, and I've written about that in my own journals. You don't understand this yet because it hasn't been taught in the universities, but trust me when I tell you that while Henry Miller and people of his time actually changed the whole concept of what a novel was in his time, and he moved it from the old stagnant form into a unconstructive form, a sort of free associational form. Eventually, that free associational form of the novel gave rise to the journal, gave rise to the diary, as it were, itself. Because we have all become, in essence, so self-possessed that only our own life is important to us. We really can't even empathize the way men could and women could in those days. And as a side note, if you look into this from the point of view of what a book was and what it did, you may not have heard of him. May thought, oh, he just writes dirty stuff. That's so not true. I want you to read what George Orwell wrote in 1940 about him in his essay called Inside the Whale. He wrote, "Here, in my opinion, is the only imaginative prose writer of the slightest value who has appeared among the English-speaking races for some years past. Even if that is objected to as an overstatement, it will probably be admitted that Henry Miller is a writer out of the ordinary, with more than a single glance, and after all, he is a completely negative, unconstructive, amoral writer, a mere Jonah, a passive acceptor of evil, a sort of Whitman among the corpses." There's another aspect of Henry Miller that you should know. Although he started out as the radical socialist bohemian in the 1920s, he spent the last years of his life at a beautiful, expensive home at 444 Ocampo Drive on the cliffs of Pacific Palisades in Los Angeles, California. It's the way of the world. It's the way of the entire world that most people start out with these, I'm a left winger, I'm a socialist, I'm an anarchist, bring it all down, man. And all they're looking for is a buck, and all they're looking for is a break, and all they're looking for is a publisher, and all they're looking for is a TV shot, or all they're looking for is a gallery, and all they're looking for is how to make a living in this crazy world. And once they do, at the end of the day, they all become the same. They want a new BMW or Mercedes, and they want to live in Pacific Palisades. It's interesting to me that it's Pacific Palisades, because another writer, who I think was terrible, incidentally, both as a human being, not bad as a writer, he was a terrible drunk, whose name I've forgotten. He also wound up owning a BMW and living in Pacific Palisades, although he glorified the life of the drunken writer. In fact, the movie Barfly was about him with Mickey Rourke many years ago. Remember that movie, Barfly, was about the writer Bukowski. Terrible human being, a total puke as a human being, but nobody could write about such minutiae in as great detail as the drunk Bukowski did. He could write page upon page about how it was to navigate a room while drunk across a living room floor. I mean, it was that good in that sense. But the topics he chose to write about were worthless. There was nothing elevating about Bukowski's work. In other words, if you wanted someone to write majestically about a fleck of vomit, you could go no further than finding it in Bukowski. But therefore, why would why would you want to read about a fleck of vomit? So therefore, he's worthless as a writer. On the other hand, Henry Miller could write about magnificent things in the most magnificent way and lift you out of yourself, as we heard when before the break I played him reading his own work about taking his aunt to an insane asylum. So let's listen to the rest. Fire away.
Walking down the gravel path toward the big gates, Mealy becomes uneasy. Even a puppy knows when it is being carried to a pond to be drowned. Mealy is trembling now. At the gate, they are waiting for us. The gate yawns. Mealy is on the inside, I am on the outside. They are trying to coax her along. They are gentle with her now. They speak to her so gently. But Mealy is terror-stricken. She turns round and runs toward the gate. I'm still standing there. She puts her arms through the bars and clutches my neck. I kiss her tenderly on the forehead. Gently, I unlock her arms. The others are going to take her again. I can't bear seeing that. I must go. I must run. For a full minute, however, I stand and look at her. Her eyes seem to have grown enormous. Two great round eyes, full and black as the night, staring at me uncomprehendingly. No maniac can look that way. No idiot can look that way. Only an angel or a saint. When I ran away from the gate, I stopped beside a high wall and burying my head in my arms against the wall, I sobbed as I had never sobbed since I was a child. Meanwhile, they were giving Mealy a bath and putting her into regulation dress. They parted her hair in the middle, brushed it down flat, and tied it into a knot at the nape of the neck. Thus, no one looks exceptional. All have the same crazy look. Whether they are half crazy or three-quarters crazy or just slightly cracked. When you say, may I have pen and ink to write a letter, they say yes, and they hand you a broom to sweep the floor.
Pause right here because the clip is longer than the segment. I'm very moved by this because there was a scene like that in my life. Unfortunately, I wasn't there to take my brother to the home, but someone in my family was, and he broke down in the same exact way as Miller. Because in those days, they didn't take care of people who they couldn't take care of. They gave them to the state, who destroyed them. That's the way it was. We live in a much better world than it was then in many ways. I'll come back with Henry Miller and Black Spring in a minute.
Savage.
Earth Angel, will you be mine? My darling dear, love you all the time.
All right, so we're going to go back, and there's a minute and a half left of Henry Miller's reading from Black Spring. We can turn off the sound. They can't do both, guys. where he commits his aunt. They give him as a child to take her to the insane asylum, and he brings her to the gates, and she starts to shake, and she's crying and scared. And, you know, this is the part of Henry Miller that I related to as much as the sexual craziness and the flights of fancy and the other stuff, because you saw a real, full, total man. Now, the idiot feminists who have never amounted to a hill of beans criticized them for being sexist and this. No one ever heard of them. No one will remember them. All they could do was attack and rip down the white male. But Henry Miller was a giant to these Lilliputians who tried to rip him apart many years ago during the nascence of the so-called feminist movement. He remains a giant amongst those who understand what literature is. Nobody writes like him anymore. Nobody can write like him. The only people around like Henry Miller are few and far between, and I'm one of them. And it's a form, you see, the art form of talk radio is misunderstood completely. And that is because it's not considered an art form. The people on the left assume that only people on the left understand art and understand form. What they don't understand is that you can love America and be an artist and know what form is. And so although most of my show is politics, I have told you that as of last week, the show was going to change because everything is political. I can do anything and make it political. I can do a show on books as I've been doing today and make it political. And I can guarantee you, even if you've listened to this show before, you've listened longer today than you've listened in a long time. And I'll make another prediction. And I'll make another prediction right now. After the November election, there's going to be a drop off the cliff of listeners to talk radio. It's going to go up and up and up right through November. Right after the election, the American people are going to turn off right until maybe 2 years from now, coming up into the presidential cycle. And those in this medium who only talk about Obama or Republicans are going to be out of business within a year. They may still be on the air. You'll never know it, but their audience is going to shrivel to about 20% of what it is, because there's only so much crap anybody can take in this world. There's only so much hokum that you're willing to buy, and there's only so much of Marjo you're willing to accept. So therefore, since I come into this world of talk radio as a grown man at the age of 50, with many other lives before me, many other paths having been walked, many other careers with tremendous knowledge of many other fields, I'm going to bring all of it to bear on this medium called talk radio, and I'm gambling that you're going to be here for me. It's a gamble. I'm not a fortune teller. I can only gamble. So let's go back for another minute or so of one of my favorite authors, a book that was transformational, to use an Obama word, Black Spring with Henry Miller.
When I ran away from the gate, I stopped beside a high wall and burying my head in my arms against the wall, I sobbed as I had never sobbed since I was a child. Meanwhile, they were giving Mealy a bath and putting her into regulation dress. They parted her hair in the middle, brushed it down flat, and tied it into a knot at the nape of the neck. Thus, no one looks exceptional. All have the same crazy look, whether they are half crazy or three-quarters crazy or just slightly cracked. When you say, "May I have pen and ink to write a letter?" they say yes, and they hand you a broom to sweep the floor. If you pee on the floor absentmindedly, you have to wipe it up. You can sob all you like, but you mustn't violate the rules of the house. A bug house has to be run in orderly fashion, just as any other house. When Mealy stood at the gate with eyes so bright and round, her mind must have traveled back like an express train. Everything must have leaped to her mind at once. Her eyes were so big and bright, as if they saw more than they could comprehend. Bright with terror, and beneath the terror, a limitless confusion. That's what made them so beautifully bright. You have to be crazy to see things so lucidly, so all at once. If you're great, you can stay that way, and people will believe in you, swear by you, turn the world upside down for you. But if you're only partly great, or just a nobody, then what happens to you is lost.
That's Henry Miller, Black Spring. And I know some people called in tears, telling my screener they couldn't call the show because they were so moved by this. And I'm really glad that I was able to stumble upon this. And Beowulf, thanks for finding it. on the internet. We didn't plan it. This is a free form show today. I thought we'd start with books and go to you, and we will in a minute on books and movies that change your life. But remember, there was so much more about Henry Miller than just this this part of him. He was a great sexist. He was a wonderful chauvinist of the old school. And he was above all an iconoclast. Iconoclast, he who knocks over icons. You got to understand what that really means in a world that has become so conformist. Because despite what the left would have you believe, they are the most conformist element in America today. The most conformist element in America today is the radical left, which would have you read what they want you to read, speak the words they want you to speak, think the thoughts they want you to think, elect the stooges they want you to elect. In other words, that's what we mean when we say politically correct. And that's what you don't understand. Many of you use it, and you understand it in a certain way, but you don't understand it in a total way. That the left wing, which claims to be wild and free and bohemian and, man, I'm far out, is really nothing but a bunch of what? What are they at the end of the day? A bunch of ninnies from the suburbs trying to tell the whole world what to think, what to eat, who to elect, how to spend their money, how much taxes to pay. In other words, petty little martinets, for want of a better phrase. And that's why I always loved Henry Miller. Because one thing he was not was a man telling me what to think and what to feel. He allowed me to think and feel what I was thinking and feeling but was unable to express, because I too grew up in a very limited world, which I defined in a little book that I wrote when I was 17 called The Green Carpeted World, The Green Carpeted World of Utopian Security. It was about my childhood, given to me by my parents, who thought that by protecting me with steam heat and three squares a day, they'd make me a better person. Well, they made me a fatter person, but at the end of the day, they didn't make me a better person. What made me a better person was freeing myself from that green carpeted world of infernal security and going out on the road, which leads me to the next book I'll discuss next week, which is Jack Kerouac's On the Road, because here I am still on my trip. Now let's go to you on the Savage Nation. I hope you've enjoyed this slight diversion from the normal Obama this, Obama that, Republicans that, bring back the draft, give me peace, man, you know, whatever. We can only do so much of that. Let's go to the callers. Robert in Houston, Texas, go ahead, please. What do you think about Literature Book Day?
Dr. Savage, I think you have found the cure for road rage. It is raining like a maniac in Houston, and it's just a sea of brake lights. And to hear something like this has got to be more calming to anybody than switching over to a leftist-type talk show that's just got a bunch of sounds like guys talking into a shoebox with piped-in nature noise. It doesn't work well, especially in Texas. We tend to roll pretty conservative here, and I think that you have found a niche. It is like an evening devotional and meditation for us all.
Thank you, Robert. That's really beautiful. It's heartfelt, and I appreciate it. Watch out in the rain. Watch out in the rain. But, of course, there's nature healing itself. You know, when the rain comes, we hate the rain. But try a drought for 30 years, and you'll see what it's like. I loved all the years in Florida. We'd hear that there was a drought, there was a drought, there was a drought. Oh, I'm dying. There's no groundwater. The swamp is drying up. The alligators are begging for government assistance. Please give the crocodiles the right to vote for Barney Frank. And all of a sudden, the rains come, and all the Floridians talk about is the flooding and the rains and how horrible the rains are. And where's Al Gore now that we don't need him? Where's Al Gore now that the glaciers are not melting? Where's Al Gore now that the UN has been exposed for the child molesters and thieves that they really are? Where's Al Gore now that the Green Movement has been shown to be nothing but a mafia front? Where's Al Gore now that we learned from Italy on my website, michaelsavage.com, with an article from England that the whole Green thing is nothing but a mafia front? That the hills of Sicily are filled with windmills that produce no electricity, yet the mafioso are generating electricity from the windmills at night using underground secret diesel generators in order to hoodwink the public and get more EU money, more euros from the European green fools while they generate electricity with diesel engines in the night and the windmills don't even turn, and yet they can still churn a profit with the government money. And the people in Sicily are screaming, they're destroying our view, they're ruining the hillside, where's the electricity? And it doesn't stop the fools on the hill. in the EU from putting out billions of euros to all of the scam artists from Palermo to Chicago to San Francisco to Ukraine, wherever they are, wherever you want to be. It's nothing but a scam. The entire green movement is nothing but a lie. But you bought it. You bought it, boy. You own it, girl. It's yours. You own it, girl. You own the green movement. It hasn't produced a kilowatt. It hasn't produced enough electricity to make a firefly light up. But you own it, girl. You own it, boy. It couldn't produce enough electricity to heat a refrigerator in the middle of the Arctic. But you, my friends, you bought it. Yeah, all those windmills haven't produced a kilowatt of electricity. But you own it, boy, and NBC bought it, boy. That's why MSNBC is on the air, girl. That's because GE owns it, girl. That's because GE did $30 trillion worth of deals with the Obama administration to build green, psychopathic, cyclonic windmills around the world that don't produce a kilowatt of electricity. Nothing but left-wing hot air on MSNBC that says Obama is great. And windmills will save you tomorrow. And I'm Michael Savage, and I've had a good time. And so I'm going to take a little break and be right back.
Savage.
All right, so we've done the music, the book thing. I'm going to read you a story that's going to make you sick. Now, you know how the leftists who run America's cities, states, and federal government hate Christianity, how they hate religion, how they hate God, how they hate the Holy Ghost, how they have a special animus for Jesus himself, how they want no prayer, no Ten Commandments. In Hartford, Connecticut, the city council has said they will open all meetings now with Muslim prayers. That's right. The city council of Hartford, Connecticut has invited local so-called imams to perform Islamic invocations at the beginning of the council meetings in September. Although meetings don't begin with any form of prayer, because it would be a separation of church and state, as you well know, an email from the Common Council in Hartford, Connecticut, called it an act of solidarity with our Muslim brothers and sisters. They said that one of the goals of the council is to give a voice to the many diverse peoples of the city, which is especially important given the recent anti-Islam events throughout the country. City Council President Joe Winch called it an important move for the council. And she said, this is going to make us a stronger council to open with Muslim prayers, while Christianity, Christian prayers and the Bible will be banned. So there's your country today. There's liberalism, the mental disorder, digging its own grave. There's the radical left, which has an animus for Christianity and Judaism that only God himself could possibly accept, has a sudden love for a religion that they don't even understand. And now let's go on to a caller in Kansas City who wants to talk about a book that moved her. Kathy, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good evening, Michael. I love the new format that you've introduced. It wasn't a book, actually. It was a movie. I was about 8 or 9, and everybody was going to watch The Old Frankenstein with Karloff. And I watched it, and I began to cry and cry and cry. And my mother was very astounded. She was afraid we were all going to get too scared, so she was kind of hovering. Mm-hmm. And she said, Kathy, what's wrong? And I cried and cried. I said, Mommy, he's a monster. He only wants somebody to love him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Karloff played it that way, and I've often thought that Karloff should have been not only nominated for an Academy Award, but won one. But that changed my...
Karloff was the Academy Award. Let's put it to you that way. Of course, he projected an empathy that actors today are incapable of. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's funny, you provoke thoughts in me about what other movies moved me. For example, remember even the movie King Kong, the look in King Kong's eyes when he's about to be killed by the airplanes atop the Empire State Building? Remember that one?
But such love still.
Yes. How about the movie Mighty Joe Young about a gorilla that was about to be killed? After taken into captivity and shown like a captured animal. What did a child feel when watching King Kong or Mighty Joe Young? The child learned to feel the animal's feelings. So, yeah, I understand what you're saying. So you're saying that's what you felt with the Frankenstein movie.
Yeah, the ugliness didn't make any difference at all. It was though even just those little noises that he made, you know, when he tried to say friend, friend.
Uh-huh.
Beautiful.
Very interesting. Beautiful. Well, let me ask you something. When I played Henry Miller tonight, did it have any effect on you?
Yes, I was very surprised, Michael. I had not known there was that side to Henry Miller. When he was put in that movie Red, that was the only time I kind of got my...
Oh, right. Warren Beatty with the movie Reds, they put Henry Miller in it. Of course, they only showed that side of him. You know, most artists and intellectuals of the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s were socialists. You know that.
Sure. Yeah.
They didn't know any better. They were all hoodwinked by the free love and the sex hooked them in. They didn't quite understand what they were getting hooked into. It was true also, by the way, for many blue-collar guys, union guys. I remember my father telling me that when he was very young, the communists in New York used to have these parties. And a lot of the union guys would go to these parties because the girls were all free with the sex. And they went there basically for that. They didn't know anything about what the communism or socialism part of it. It just knew that the communist women were, easy to be with. That's all. So that's how they were selling communism then.
Yes. Wonderful, Michael. I love your new format.
Okay. Thanks for listening. As far away as Kansas City. You see, even people in Kansas read books. You wouldn't know that. You think they only read books on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. But little did you know that people in Kansas, like the last caller, actually read books. So, you know, this is very good, and this is going to go on. I mean, God willing, it's going to be every Tuesday. Books and movies that change your life. I can't guarantee you that I'll be able to touch you the way I did today. I didn't even want to do this today. I kind of was bored already in advance of my new format. This is how I am. I create a format and I wanted to abandon it today already, even though I did it all of last week. By today, even though I was off yesterday, I wanted to abandon the format and, and go back to no format at all, because I don't like structure. It drives me crazy. At this phase of my life, I want less structure than you can imagine. And so I'm even thinking about, well, I'll get to that another time. Maybe moving to Norway or Finland and watching the sun rise and stay in the sky for 6 months. And I don't know. It might be fun to do nothing, I was thinking, after all these years of living by the second, where one syllable or one word can destroy a career. Oh, don't I know that well. How would you like to live by the clock where every second ticks away and ticks away and ticks away? And if you miss one beat of 1 second and say one word that someone doesn't like and it's the wrong someone, the next thing you know, you're banned in England or something after that, maybe even worse. How'd you like to live like that? Why don't you try it sometime? Try those shoes on. Walk in my moccasins for a day. Try walking in my moccasins for 16 years. Try walking in my moccasins on glass across hot coals for 16 years. Try crawling on broken glass and hot coals for 16 years and not get burned, because if you can, then you'll be a man, my son. But you can do it, especially if you've been to Benga and you've learned the secrets of the firewalkers who know how to walk across hot coals without burning their feet. You see, it's all a little trick of the mind to walk across hot coals of the mind without singeing the brain, how to step upon thorns without feeling them in your crown, how to feel that crown without being picked by the thorns, without bleeding from the thorns. It's all a matter of the mind. But at some point, you want to get off the mortal coil, don't you? You just want to disappear into the night with the white hat pulled down over your eyes and go under an assumed name, never being heard from again, and yet living better than you've lived for the 16 years previous when you live by the clock.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
up above, take care of the one I love.
For those of us who are Jews who are part of this undertaking, both the ones who are here, Jewish leaders who are here, and some who couldn't be because of the proximity of the holiday, but were part of the preparation for this, we could be nowhere else. We have been the quintessential victims of religious persecution and discrimination throughout history. We know what it is like when people have attacked us verbally, have attacked us physically, and others have remained silent. It cannot happen here in America in 2010 without the response of the religious community.
Oh, my darling, rest your head. Salmon will be coming soon, singing you a slumber tune.
This week continues the new format in the Savage Nation, which I began last week. The questions that we're dealing with today, which book or movie changed your life? Or which movie or book, which is considered great by the media, do you feel is overrated? Do you feel that schools have turned away from great books because too much of it is written by white males? And what was your favorite passage from a great work of, you know, a great book? These are some of the questions, and some of the great books that we touched on were, Time Critics have listed the 100 best English language novels from 1923 to the present. For whatever it's worth, I agree with some of them. Some of them, of course, are there only because of the political elements of them. But see if any of these books ring a bell as I read them to you. The titles: The Adventures of Augie March, 1953, by Saul Bellow. Bet you some of you read that. Animal Farm by George Orwell, 1946. Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. The Catcher in the Rye, 51 by J.D. Salinger. A Clockwork Orange, 1963 by Anthony Burgess. The Day of the Locust, 1939 by Nathaniel West. Any of these ring a bell? Did they affect your life? Gone with the Wind, 1936 by Margaret Mitchell. Grapes of Wrath, 39, John Steinbeck. Great Gatsby, 1925, F. Scott Fitzgerald. How about The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, 1940, by Carson McCullers, an amazing book. Herzog by Saul Bellow. Ever hear of any of these? The Invisible Man, 1952, by Ralph Ellison. Any of these ring a bell? Lolita, 1955, by Nabokov. How about Lord of the Flies, by William Golding, from 1955? Well, I bet some of them ring a bell. Have you heard of 1984? By George Orwell. It was published in 1948 by George Orwell. How about one that affected my life, On the Road, Jack Kerouac, 1957. These are all considered great books. How about Portnoy's Complaint, 1969, by Philip Roth? How about, a few more, The Sun Also Rises, 1926, by Ernest Hemingway? Let's see. Oh, here, Henry Miller, Tropic of Cancer. Under the Volcano, unbelievable movie if you never saw that one. Under the Volcano, 1947, by Malcolm Lowry. Well, those are some of the great books, according to one reviewer. And, of course, I've asked you what your choices are as well. It's a very interesting topic. Wednesdays will be devoted, as we did last week, to finance and money. Thursdays will be devoted to, I forgot already, nutrition and health, because of my great background in the books and the vitamin industry and things of that nature, including my incredibly important book, Healing Children Naturally, where A to Z natural approaches for natural complaints are given, where it's important for you to understand my approach. Food is the best medicine, and I give recipes for resistors and diets for prospective parents, how to improve a sperm count in males. You may not know it, but food can affect all of these things. And here's the first line. I'm so proud of it, I want to read it again because it was written in 81. Just as the undrawn sword is the mark of the best swordsman, so too is the best physician one who relies least on synthetic drugs to heal. That's a pretty good line. So Healing Children Naturally is a health book, and Thursdays we do health and nutrition. And then on Friday, I did religion last Friday. I read from the Bible and showed you how political it is, which brings us back to the beginning of the loop. All of these topics are political. There's nothing more political than health. Look at Obamacare. Nothing more political than religion. Look at the issue of the Ground Zero Mosque. And look at the news today on the Ground Zero Mosque. Take a guess who's backing the Ground Zero Mosque. Well, you know who. Of course, it's Mayor Bloomberg. And he's defending it on the issue of First Amendment freedom of religion, which he's totally wrong about, incidentally, because the developer is a crook. The developer owes the city money. The developer has scammed the city for money before. He knows that. But if you look at who the president is and you see that Michelle Obama is holding a music event in the White House where the Bump and Grind will be featured as one of the dances, how much further do we have to go to see how classy the Obamas really are? They're a heck of a classy couple. You know, you could see what they do in the White House. And then in the middle of his speech, Obama says that they talk about me like a dog. Can you believe this? 2 months to go before Election Day, Obama kicks off the fall campaign Monday with an attacking a speech attacking Republicans. And off script, he accused his GOP critics of talking about him, quote, like a dog. He said, some powerful interests who had been dominating the agenda in Washington for a very long time, and they're not always happy with me, they talk about me like a dog. That's not in my prepared remarks, but it's true. Close quote. He said that during a speech at Wisconsin's Labor Fest on Monday. Well, what does he mean by that, and where did it come from? Well, it comes from Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix, although was not acknowledged by Obama, the line was a verbatim quote from Stone Free, the first song Hendrix wrote after moving to England in 1966. The song says, they talk about me like a dog, talking about the clothes they wear, but they don't realize they're the ones who square. Now, did Obama consciously or unconsciously cite the lyric? They wouldn't know. Okay? If only the Republicans win, everything will be fine, because they're the good guys and the Democrats are the bad guys. That's the way the game is played. I was taught that when I was a little boy in New York. My father took me by the hand. Just think of me as a kid who knew nothing, because all kids know nothing. I know many liberals think their children are brilliant, but most children are, they know nothing. So children know nothing just as dogs know nothing. But Americans are so naive, they think that there's wisdom in a child, and they get on their hands and knees and ask a child what they think. What would you like for dinner, honey? What does a child know? They watch television. They want Jell-O. You want it to eat Jell-O? Or vote for Democrats about the same thing. So Dad took me by the hand. He knew it was a dangerous country. And he said, look, Michael, here's the way it is. I'm an immigrant to this country. And the way it works is a beautiful country. It's a great country. And he said, one band of crooks gets the power called the Democrats. And then all the years they're in power, the crooks call the Republicans, point their fingers at them and say they're no good. They did this. They did that. And then the American people naively put in the other crooks, the Republicans. And then for the next 4 years, the Democrats point their fingers and say, look at those crooked Republicans. Why, if you put us back in office, we'll straighten things out. You'll have the most honest government in history. And you wind up with Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid. And now we think we're going to wind up with Newt Gingrich. Are you people crazy? Don't you understand that there is no fundamental difference? There are some structural differences in some ways, but at the end of the day, not a heck of a lot of difference. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Well, it's another day, therefore we got to expect another gem from that great mayor of New York, Bloomberg, and he delivered for us. Here's the question.
Fox 5 News has learned that one of the developers of this project, Hisham Elzanati, actually contributed to a terrorist organization back in 1999. In any way, sir, does this change the situation for you? Do you think it warrants at least further investigation?
And now, here's Bloomberg.
I think the Constitution of the United States, which we've had for an awful long time, can withstand anything, and I don't think we should be in the business of investigating where religious organizations get their money. Do you want them to go into your church or your temple or your mosque and ask where all the money comes from? I don't think so. This is plain and simple a First Amendment
but
issue.
He doesn't answer the question, does he? Staying with the Ground Zero Mosque, here's a so-called Rabbi Saperstein. Remember, the word rabbi only means teacher. This is a far-left radical who happens to have a divinity degree from some second-rate college, So-called Rabbi Saperstein compares building the mosque and opposing the mosque to the persecution of the Jews.
For those of us who are Jews who are part of this undertaking, both the ones who are here, Jewish leaders who are here, and some who couldn't be because of the proximity of the holiday, but were part of the preparation for this, we could be nowhere else. We have been the quintessential victims of religious persecution and discrimination throughout history. We know what it is like when people have attacked us verbally, have attacked us physically, and others have remained silent. It cannot happen here in America.
Stop this insanity, Rab.
Without the response of the religious
community. How can you compare the two, dummy? But Rabbi Dummy goes on.
And we speak out because we know that hate crimes and hate speech are not mere acts of disreputable talk, of murder or assaults or arsons or derisive conversation or desecrations. They're attacks on the pillars of our republic and the guarantors of our freedom.
And Rabbi Dummy goes on.
Such actions, such speech are a betrayal of the promise of America. They erode our national well-being. And those who commit those crimes do so fully intending to pull apart the too often frayed threads of diversity that should bind us together and that makes us
and
strong.
Rabbi Dummy goes on.
These people seek to divide and conquer.
Dividing and conquer?
They do damage to America across the globe. They do damage to us internally. They seek to tear us apart from within. Pitting American against American, fomenting violence, civil discord, and we stand here.
It's the Muslims who are dividing and conquer, dummy. And of course, that other great pillar of democracy, George Soros, is giving $100 million to the group Human Rights Watch, which has never found anything America does to be right and ignores everything that is wrong in the Arab countries.
I cut my teeth in philanthropy with Human Rights Watch. So I know them very well, and it's very unusual for an organization to be able to grow and not lose its initial zeal, so to speak, and its quality. It's an American organization, and that has become a drawback because America has lost the moral high ground for promoting human rights. So I want the organization to become truly international with maybe the American members in the minority.
This is the same group that want our borders torn apart.
The United States has lost the moral high ground that under the Bush administration there have been many human rights violations committed by Americans, and that has sort of endangered the credibility, the legitimacy of Americans being in the forefront of advocating human rights. And that is a big setback.
Why are we in Afghanistan? I'll give you my opinion again for 2 cents worth, whatever it's worth, 5 cents, 2 cents, a gold doubloon, gold coin. Gold doubloon. For one gold doubloon, I'll give you my opinion. And here it is. I say get out of Afghanistan, create a vacuum, let Al-Qaeda rush in from around the world, from Dearborn, from Brooklyn, from Paris, from Rome, from Jerusalem, wherever they may be. Let them rush into Afghanistan and celebrate and chant Allah Akbar. Let them erect a temple to their hate. And let them plan the overthrow of the West. And then when enough of them are there, treat them the way we treated the Germans and the Japanese in World War II. Treat them to the inferno they've been asking for. That's the only thing that's going to work, because you can't win in a counterinsurgency war. It didn't work in Vietnam. It did not really work in Vietnam, this whole concept of a one hand behind your back. How can it work when you have a powerful military and you put men in hand-to-hand combat and you say, tie one hand behind your back? I mean, I'm giving you common sense. I'm being an armchair general for now. Doesn't matter that I didn't serve in the military. I am an analytical man. I can figure things out. There are people who did serve in the military who don't know their behinds from their elbows. So what's the difference? Take a look at that general who ran for the presidency. He's a genius.
whatever the hell his name was, Wesley Clark. You think he's a great genius? How many other people served in the military who are not worth a damn when it comes to America and patriotism? So don't tell me because they serve in the military, they're necessarily smarter than everybody else. And also don't tell me that because I didn't serve in the military, I have no right to render an opinion. Most of America never served in the military, yet we all have an opinion. So I'll give you mine if you don't mind. I'll give you a little more of mine. I say get the hell out of Afghanistan now. And let Al-Qaeda rush into that vacuum. Let them agglutinate like the viruses that they are. Let them come from afar, from Dearborn, from Los Angeles, from San Francisco, from Jerusalem, from Syria, from Assyria, from Turkey, from Palestine, from the Caucasus. Let them come from around the world until there's millions of them there, and they finally have their homeland. And then I say treat them to the inferno they've been begging for, so they can all share in those 32 virgins. We are at war or we're not at war? Well, apparently we're at war, but we have people that don't understand that we're at war. As far as I know, there's never been a declaration of war. Anyway, we could talk about anything you want here. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Around 1 o'clock, they say a man with a gun, possibly some explosive, goes into the lobby of the Discovery building.
The man has something strapped to his chest and has hostages, plural, hostages.
Can't confirm his name. He's an Asian male, and his concerns are with the Discovery Corporation right now.
No, it's an adult male, Asian.
We don't know that he, in fact, what he has strapped around him is a bomb.
Law enforcement officials tell us that his name is James J. Lee.
Now, it's no surprise that once the media found out the Discovery Channel killer and terrorist and kidnapper, that he was a left-wing fanatic disciple of Al Gore, they made the story disappear. Disappear, oh, gone. We know if he was a conservative, we would still be hearing about, well, every detail about his life 24 hours a day. Joining us now to talk about this obvious media insanity is columnist Jack Hunter.
Good to be with you as always, Michael. I'd like to talk a little bit today about this this gunman, hostage taker, whatever you like to hear call him. We've all heard about the guy who walked into the Discovery Channel and sort of made demands. He was sort of inspired, he said, awakened, I think was his actual word, by Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. Just to give you some perspective on where this guy is coming from, his website said something to the effect, well, it's actually a quote, quote, nothing is more important than saving the lions, tigers, giraffes, elephants, froggies, turtles, apes, raccoons, beetles, ants, sharks, bears, and of course, the squirrels. The humans? The planet does not need humans. Now, suffice to say, this guy is what you'd call an extreme environmentalist, certainly out there on the fringe, and has even admitted that he was inspired, as I said, by Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. What is curious to me, what is interesting and almost amusing even, is the degree to which the left has not tried to link this guy's actions, what he did, his extremism, if you will, with their own rhetoric, just like they do to the right on a frequent basis.
Well, what do you really mean by that?
Of course, we could go all the way back to, you know, Timothy McVeigh, and people were blaming, you know, his actions on sort of this militia mentality that was inspired by conservative talk radio and the mainstream conservative movement in general. More recently, if you'll remember the guy, the neo-Nazi James von Braun, who walked into the Holocaust Memorial Museum and shot a security guard, killed the man. How often did we hear that this was the fault of people like you, Michael, and talk radio in general, or the mainstream conservative movement, I don't know, Fox News? We always hear from the left that anytime some extremist does something crazy or something tragic, that it is always the fault of conservatives at large.
Well, it's a very easy standard that they follow.
But the standard obviously has not been applied to this gentleman, James J. Lee, who is carrying out extremism from a definitively left-wing point of view. I did not hear Chris Matthews even mention that maybe his own rhetoric had stoked fear and hatred out there and led to these actions. Keith Olbermann, the same, complete silence. Rachel Maddow, Ed Schultz, that entire channel over there at MSNBC, the left, the Washington Post, the New York Times, you don't hear anybody trying to make those connections. Why? because it's absurd. The point is they don't see the absurdity on both sides. I think we can both agree to that.
Their bias is very obvious. Where are the talking heads that point it out from the so-called midstream media?
Well, we've often talked about the liberal media, and this is just sort of drives that point home, that they don't apply the same standards to themselves, being 99.9% liberal, that they do to the right and to conservatives. And you just don't have to look at tragedies to see this double standard in play. You can just look at the coverage of the Tea Party movement.
Well, that's right. The media's been trying to silence them for quite a while.
Every time you see the left report on it, or just the mainstream media, which we all know tends to trend left, it's always saying that these people are extremists, is there going to be violence, is something horrible going to happen. Compare that to the anti-war protesters when George W. Bush was in office. And this has nothing to do with how you feel about the Tea Parties or the Iraq or Afghanistan war. I'm talking about just the coverage. If you look at how they covered, or refused to cover in some instances, pretty much ignored the anti-war protesters, there were people out there with signs showing George W. Bush as a Nazi and comparing Dick Cheney to Hitler, and the same sort of fringe sort of wackiness you might see at the Tea Parties with some signs with some people who might go a little bit too far. But did anybody ever suggest that being against the Iraq war or the Afghanistan war meant that you agreed with these people with these wacky signs? No, they didn't draw those connections.
Okay, all of a sudden Code Pink no longer exists in the media. Why is that?
That fringe was okay and could be dismissed, and there was a good argument to be made against Bush's foreign policy. But when it comes to the Tea Party and their criticism of Barack Obama, and, oh, I don't know, a $14 trillion debt, and, oh, I don't know, national health care, and all these big programs, well, it must just be extreme misbehavior. It can't just be that, well, yeah, there's a few, you know, people on the fringe, but by and large, there's a good critique to be made of this president, his party, and their agenda. They never go there, and the double standard is just flamingly, so obvious, it's beyond ridiculous. It's beyond absurd.
We're starting to see a trickle of people in the media speaking out against the direction Obama's taking things. Do you think this is a change in the media or just a little, well, window dressing?
Well, I think with Obama becoming more unpopular, I think he's at 42 or 44% popularity if you look at the polls, and that's certainly different from where it was in 2008. Time magazine was once proclaiming him the new FDR and talking about a new deal or something to that effect, and now it says Mr. Unpopular on the cover of Time magazine. So you are going to see probably mainstream outlets generally consider critiquing this president and the Democrats and all of the different things that have got the Tea Partiers in an uproar, and rightfully so, giving it a little bit more credit. But by and large, that liberal bias is still there.
I'm not sure this bias is ever going to disappear.
It is no more clear than how they've sort of pretended that this James J. Lee guy is somehow not some sort of left-wing extremist, which he obviously is, in the same way that they applied that standard to guys like James Von Brunn or even going back to Timothy McVeigh. I think that's the difference. Yeah, what we see in the media coverage. But you are right, Michael, that there is probably going to be a little bit more leeway given to those of us like you and I who do criticize this president on a regular basis. Those,
well, of course not. The elitists never do.
We all know they're all going to call us crazy, extreme, and fringe in the end, especially if Obama starts to regain his popularity. Let's look at the situation with Murkowski up there in Alaska, who had to step down, of course, Joe Miller, the Tea Party candidate. Now, if we're talking about media coverage, whether it's this James J. Lee or the Tea Parties or this double standard we're discussing, I watched, and, you know, I do this to keep up with the enemy, quite frankly. People ask why I torture myself. I watched Chris Matthews, Hardball, before that election in Alaska, that primary election, and he was basically saying, why would Sarah Palin endorse this Joe Miller candidate? Obviously, Murkowski is going to be the winner, and this is ridiculous. What kind of game is she playing? Well, lo and behold, of course, Joe Miller won that race, and the reason I bring that up, it is a microcosm of how the mainstream media does not get the Tea Party as a whole. Going into 2010, going into 2012, they do not understand the amount of seething grassroots anger and concern, quite frankly, about the direction of this country. That Alaska situation is just a microcosm of what they don't understand, and that parlays into their coverage of what they consider extreme or fringe and all the rest. It's the media elite, whether in New York or Los Angeles, or most importantly, probably, the Beltway in Washington, D.C., who are not connected at all to the heartland of this country, which is the Tea Party, and who get it and understand that we are going in the wrong direction. They don't understand that, and therefore the media can't cover it correctly.
Unless they stop trying to destroy our borders, language, and culture.
Yeah, the thing about it, Michael, is no matter what we do as conservatives, no matter how serious a critique we put out there, if we say, hey, A, B, and C is going to happen, Democrats and President Obama, if you do A, B, and C, and then we're proven right, it doesn't matter. The media is never going to give us a fair shake. You've dealt with this your entire career. I know exactly what it's like. The Tea Party is learning as they become more politically active. That double standard will always be applied. We started off talking about James J. Lee. And how is this double standard that this obvious, you know, extreme left terrorist, quite frankly, is not connected to the larger mainstream left and liberalism in general, the way they do with conservatives and guys like Timothy McVeigh or James Von Brunn, the Holocaust Memorial Museum shooter. That extends to how they view the Tea Party, all of us conservatives out there in the hinterlands, all us, you know, crazy rubes and wackos who show up at these Tea Parties and show signs.
Well, you mean those of us who love our country are the enemy, right?
They don't get us. They don't get why we're concerned. They don't get that we are genuinely fearful about the direction of this country, and the fact that they don't get it means they can't cover the movement directly. The Tea Party needs to create its own narrative, as it's already doing politically, but also media-wise, and just ignore the mainstream altogether.
Well, thanks for the report, Jack.
It's always good to be with you, Michael. If you'd like to learn about this and more, I encourage your listeners to visit SouthernAvenger.com. Y'all take care.
The so-called elites on the left, the America haters, don't understand the Tea Party. They're afraid of them. They only have empathy for left-wing lunatics like Lee, who was just passionate about the environment. But when it comes to our country's survival, well, I guess they're threatened by that because they hate our country. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Polls are showing Democrats are way in the dumps. Democrats are abandoning Obama in droves. He's attacking the middle class at every turn. He's trashing the White House at every turn. He's debasing America at every turn. So the fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter what he says, his own party is really fed up with him. Really fed up with him, believe me. Really, 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 really fed up with him. Now we have a couple of news stories for today from MichaelSavage.com. Where we realize that an extremist preacher is going to burn copies of the Muslim holy book outside his church in Florida. And, of course, the fanatic Muslims are going crazy because they don't believe in freedom of speech, freedom of religion, or any such freedoms. They believe only in the sanctity of the holy book. And most of them don't read anything but that book. So he's going to burn the Quran. Actually, he's allowed to do what he wants. After all, haven't the liberals told us that they can burn an American flag? Haven't we heard for years it's only freedom of expression and that's what our troops are dying for? For the right to even burn the American flag? Well, take a guess what some liberals are saying today about burning the Quran. They're not as open as you would think. No. Oh, no, you wouldn't know that. Read all about it on MichaelSavage.com. Also, see my new book, Trickle Up Poverty. Not yet out. You can pre-order it today on sale everywhere October 5th. There's so many stories, but the biggest one to me are the ones I read. Listen to this one. A mosque building owners turned down millions to sell the Ground Zero site cheaply. Did you read about that? You can't believe this. How about we are ruled by professors? No kidding. Obama calls for another $50 billion in spending. How about that? Didn't hear any of those, huh? Well, it's all on MichaelSavage.com. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Sharpton's attacks deadbeat, says a headline, but he keeps on screaming about racism. And in Florida, you want to see how all immigrants come here because they're so superior to the white male? Two men accused of butchering horses alive to sell their meat while they're living. Both Cubans. Yeah, all immigrants are better than the white male. Just ask the radicals who have told you that. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number. Let's go to New York City, WOR. Jeff, go ahead. Please tell us about fate in your life.
Michael, in 1996, I took a job in Two World Trade on the 95th floor. I worked there until April of 2001. Mm. In February of 2001, I got offered a new job, but it was contingent on passing three financial service exams. The first two I passed no problem. The third one I struggled with. I was sitting in my chair at the test terminal, changing answers, totally nervous, and finally, after changing a few answers, I said, all right, enough. and I hit the enter button. I got my score back. I passed within three questions, Michael. Three questions.
Wow. All right. So now you passed, and what happened next?
April of 2001, that was my last day, and that basically got me out of, and to be honest with you, I don't know whether I would have stayed when 9/11 happened, whether I would have gone back up into the building, who knows, but as far as I know, that got me out of there.
Oh, because you passed the test, you got out of that job in the World Trade Center, you're saying?
Exactly.
Oh, you mean how does fate, like the turns of fate. Well, it's like, what road do you want to go down? You're out for a drive, and you turn one way, and you come home safely. And you don't know whether if you'd gone down the other road, you would have been hijacked, or a car blew up, or hit by a sideswipe. You know, you never know on the highway. So do you believe in fate, or you believe in predestination, rather, or do you believe in self-determination?
A combination of both, actually. I mean,
Right, that's right. There has to be something... You know, how do you determine it? I mean, I used to watch fights. My father was a big fight fan. So every Friday night, I'd watch the fights with him. I could, to this day, remember him sitting in the chair with the undershirt with my uncle, and they would be watching the fights. And I would remember to this day, particularly the Spanish fighters. The fighters are Spanish descent. They were largely Puerto Rican descent, some of them, if I remember. They would, beginning of the fight, they'd get down on their knees in both corners and pray to God. They were praying to the same God, that God would give them the power to defeat the other man. I thought that was bizarre. You know what I'm saying? I didn't understand it as a child. How could God decide, what, he's praying to him and God likes him, so he's praying and God likes him, yet someone has to win, someone has to lose, right?
Right.
I didn't understand it. Yet the men had to pray in order to derive the energy they were looking for, in order to fight better, to have faith in themselves, to have faith in God. I remember those days. Do sporting figures still pray before a match? Do you ever see that anymore? I haven't seen this in a long time. I mean, I still watch the cage fighting. I watch the, the extreme fighting once in a while. I can't watch it for too long because it's too brutal, frankly. I don't like seeing tremendously powerful, good-looking men being beaten almost to death. I don't like, there's something about it I don't enjoy. I don't get off on it. I just don't enjoy it. Boxing I can watch because it's a matter of skill and they're so closely matched, most of them, that thankfully neither of them come out completely, bashed.
We'll keep talking about this and other topics on the show today, but let's stop for a minute. I know you listen because this is one of the last places you can get real, honest, independent, conservative opinions and unfiltered news. And I want you to get the full impact of the Savage Nation. Go to TRN1.com, become a premium member, and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast at TRN1.com. Click on my picture at TRN1.com today.
Isn't it interesting and intriguing that those who speak the loudest for the immigrant, the illegal alien, the poor, happen to be the wealthiest? Quite interesting to me how that works. Some went way up on the list. New faces in the top wealthiest 50, including Rep. Patrick Kennedy. Democrat Rhode Island. D stands for drunk. Oh, Democrat. Representative Patrick Kennedy, drunk Rhode Island, who received an inheritance after his late father, Senator Edward Kennedy, drunk Massachusetts, Democrat Massachusetts, died in 2009. 27 Dems with 23 Republicans make up the 50th richest in Congress. They don't tell you how many each has. That's the bulk of Kerry's wealth is credited with his spouse, Teresa Hines Kerry, who inherited hundreds of millions of dollars after her late husband, the ketchup baron, Senator John Hines, R.P. in Pennsylvania, died in a plane crash in 1991. I like Hines ketchup. I don't like Hunt's. It's funny how one product is better than another. I always try like Hunt's. Like certain product, you try the other. Nah. The worst was hippie ketchup. Remember the years that you tried hippie ketchup? There was no sugar in it. Disgusting. They made it with something. I don't know. No corn syrup. Give me corn syrup better. In a sense, I don't eat it. I hate corn syrup. It's not good for me. But if I'm going to have ketchup, I want it to taste exactly right. So a little bit of the money for a little coinage goes into Kerry's pocket. What can I do? I'm going to be guilty over it every time I have a hamburger? You think I think of Kerry? Nah, not really. I don't. Like when I watch Saving Private Ryan, you think I thought of Spielberg's politics? Not really. Nah, I'm not into boycotts. But there's other products like that where one is excellent and the other one is you can't eat it.
It's in sodas. It's in beers. It's like drinking water. I never drank anything as bad in my life. How does that beer survive? They don't advertise. Neither of them do. I mean, I like a certain Dutch beer. I like a German beer, a Dutch beer, ethnic thing, and the beer stinks. Who drinks beer with a lime in it to begin with? Why do you need a lime in the top of a beer bottle? What is the... Who ever heard of such a thing? Whatever. Got distracted. We were talking about fate. It's all personal taste. Scotch. You want to talk about scotch? Your favorite scotch? Please don't do that. I'm going to get the drunk. I'm right here at Rhode Island now. I got to tell you, you run out of money here with that scotch talk. I got to tell you. Yeah, I like this. Glenfiddich, I like.
So, the news and reviews. News, views, and reviews. I defined that as such on the Savage Nation when I was a local talk show host. That was already stolen, too.
Savage.